Welcome back, everyone. It's Coot here. Welcome back to the Secret to Success Summit 2016 Success School. The summit has been amazing with amazing visionaries just sharing their love and their insights and their best practices on what it really takes to create success in one's life. But we are also expanding the definition of success and redefining it, expanding it, deepening it, deepening one's definition of success. And my vision is that you really, more than simply manifesting things in your life, connect more deeply with who you are and live your true soul's potential in this lifetime. So it's been an amazing summit, and I hope you've been putting into practice the principles and ideas that have been shared so far. You know, I think each session, I always I'm so excited to interview my special guest, but I have to say that this time I'm just literally jumping out of my seat with excitement. My heart is pounding with joy to bring the man I'm about to share with you into the conversation. He's been an inspiration to me. I had the chance to read his books about 14, 15 years ago. Had the beautiful privilege of meeting him and interviewing him in San Francisco. I think it was in 2000 or 2001. It was a life-changing hour interview that has touched my life and lived with me ever since. And when he said yes to being a part and sharing his love, I was just overjoyed. So I'm going to be welcoming in a moment the one and only Andrew Harvey. He was the founder, director of the Institute of Sacred Activism. An amazing author. His books are amazing. You may have read some of his books, Way of Passion, The Celebration of Rumi, Perfume of the Desert, and many more. I was just reading on his website just a moment ago a quote from Marianne Williamson, just to give you a sense of who this man is. She said about him, every age has its teachers who keep the eternal truths alive for us all. And when a generation is very, very lucky, it encounters a teacher so illumined that the words he delivers must be illumined as well. In the case of Andrew Harvey, the light he sheds is like a meteor burst across the inner sky. So it's my privilege and honor to introduce you all to Andrew Harvey. Andrew, welcome to the Secret to Success Summit.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that wonderful and totally undeserved introduction, but I am basking in the glow of it. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Basking it. So it's a joy to have you, you know, and I remember having an interview with you in San Francisco years ago, and it's honestly never left me. And I want to thank you for your kindness, and you're someone who I feel is really living and embodying, you know, in quotation marks, real success, at least for me and my experience of you. So for those that don't know, I would love for you to take a moment, Andrew, and just share a bit about your story, and then I have a whole bunch of questions I'd love to delve into. But I would love just to set a context so people get a sense of who you are from yourself, if you would take a moment and just share a bit about yourself.
Well, I think the most important thing about my life is that I was born in India. I was born in India and had Indian blood from my father's side while being British. So I was a bridge person from the very beginning, and my whole life, in a way, has been an attempt to bridge the deepest vision of the East with the deepest vision of the West, the deepest vision of the East being this glorious understanding of our divine identity that radiates through Hinduism and Buddhism, and the greatest vision of the West being this fundamentally optimistic understanding of the individual and his or her evolutionary destiny. I came to England when I was 9 and went through the punishing weird rigor of the English system. I overachieved wildly and became a professor at Oxford when I was 21. At 25, I had a breakdown, really. I saw the emptiness and vanity and craziness of the academic world, and I went back to India, and I had a series of overwhelming mystical experiences there which gave me the direction of my life. And what happened then is that I plunged into various mystical systems to be educated and hopefully transformed. I went to Ladakh and I met a great Buddhist teacher, Tuksi Rinpoche. I wrote my first prose book there, Journey to Ladakh. I went to Pondicherry and met a very powerful Hindu teacher, Mother Meera, and became her devotee. And I was living in Paris after fleeing Oxford. And there I really undertook the study of Rumi, which has been a great passion of mine, under a wonderful teacher, Eva de Vitray Meyerovich. What happened then was that I had a series of disastrous love affairs, quite honestly, which again brought me against a wall. And at the age of 34, I went back to deep meditation with Meera. And at the age of 36, I had a major enlightenment experience, small e, which changed everything. What happened then was that I asked myself the question, what is this experience for? Why have I been graced this understanding that the whole universe is being created by light? And that was a question that I really wrestled with. And the first answer came from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who remains for me a core teacher. I interviewed him at Oslo when he won the Nobel Prize, and at the end of the interview I couldn't actually get out of my chair because the power of his presence was so overwhelming. His love, his great compassion pinned me to the chair, and he got up and laughed because he must be used to this kind of reaction. And I stood up and I found myself body to body, breast to breast with His Holiness, and I looked up at him and I said, I'll never be as close to you again like this. So what is the meaning of life? And he laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed, and then he said the words that have really been the key words for my whole journey since. He said, the meaning of life is to embody the transcendent, not just to connect with the divine, not just to have divine experiences, not just to revel in mystical beauty and ecstasy and peace, but to put them into radical embodiment, to embody them in the way you live and in the way you act. And I can't think of a more holy definition of success than that, actually. If success means anything in the deepest sense, it is insofar as you embody the transcendent, you are successful, because that's the highest calling we have on the earth. My journey then darkened because I had to leave my guru, Mother Meera, because she proved to be homophobic, and that plunged my life into a savage dark night. But towards the end of it, I met an amazing man called Father Bede Griffiths, who was the greatest living Christian mystic. And Father Bede really reconciled me with the Christianity of my childhood. And although I wouldn't say I was a Christian, I would say that I hope I'm on the Christ path.
Yes.
5 years later, I had a vision of the Christ. When my father was dying in a church in Coimbatore, I saw the resurrected Christ, and afterwards I saw a man without arms and without legs, and I heard a voice saying very, very strongly to me, look, the world is burning. There are terrible things happening all over the world. The being you see in front of you is one of millions, hundreds of millions that are suffering horribly. You've been playing with your mystical experiences. What now must happen if the world is going to be saved from itself is a revolution of love in action. And that birthed the work that I've been doing ever since, which is dedicated to what I call sacred activism, which is fundamentally the fusion of deep mystical practice and spiritual knowledge and spiritual passion with radical action in the world, because I believe that that is the force that can change this terrifying situation into something that could co-create with the divine a new way of being and doing everything. So that's the snapshot of my wild.
Yes. Thank you. That's beautiful. It gives, I think, everyone listening, especially those that may not be aware of your work, a context in a sense. Amazing. And we're talking about success, and you kind of touched on it a little bit. I want to go a little deeper into that question in terms of we're exploring what is success. And I think so often in our culture today, we've been conditioned and hypnotized and programmed to believe success is just achievement and material and bank account and just the physical level of things. And ultimately, as you definitely know, there's so much more. And you talked about embodying the transcendent. So I'm curious, based on everything you've been through, your mystical experiences, sacred activism, writing books, being a best-selling author, the whole range. What is success to you? What have you come to? What does it mean? You touched on embodying the transcendent. I'd love to explore this whole kind of notion of success. Like, what does success mean to you?
Success for me is honoring the sacred mission of your life.
Mm.
Finding it, cherishing it, nourishing it, and incarnating it, whatever it costs. And it will always cost a great deal. I am not beglamoured by the fame that I have been able to accrue. I'm not excited by the number of books I've sold. I have met in my life, through grace, extraordinary beings such as the Dalai Lama and my great teacher, Father Bede Griffiths. And they, for me, are the Everests of success, sublime beings who are in absolute service to humanity and whose whole life, from the beginning to the end, are dedicated to helping others, nourishing others, supporting others, illumining others. That, to me, is the only success that I could possibly aspire to. And insofar as I'm getting wiser and calmer and humbler and more loving, I count myself more successful. But I know I have a long way to go before that kind of success, which is the only one that means anything to me, is realized completely within me.
You talked about incarnating it, and like no matter, you said something like no matter what, and I'm wondering, you know, because just because you find your path and your purpose in life and express that, it's not always an easy path, and we've been talking about that with some of the guests as a part of the summit. So I'm wondering, you know, how much, I guess, is suffering necessary on the path? It's going to be challenging.
Absolutely. Of course it's necessary. It's the New Age nonsense about suffering is really an obscenity. Suffering is essential because only sometimes very extreme forms of suffering can really wake you up to the shadows that have been secretly dominating your life. And only suffering can truly initiate you into the depths of what the whole world is suffering. Animals are suffering, human beings are suffering, and it's when you really shoulder your own portion of suffering that initiation breaks you open to the pain of the world and makes you fundamentally compassionate to all beings who are going through this enormous dangerous journey that is life. And at certain stages of the path, at the highest stages, very extreme suffering happens because there is no entry into divine identity without the dark night process. And the dark night process isn't just a trauma, isn't just a series of difficulties. It is a burning away of the false self in an excruciating ordeal, which can drive you mad and can kill you. But if you hang in there and pray and fall on your knees and beg for help, will actually transform you. So I don't think we should be... The beautiful thing, though, about the suffering on the path is that after initial hysteria about it, you come to accept it because you come to understand by degrees what St. Francis meant when he said, you suffer on the path like a bird sings. So suffering becomes a form of love, a deep form of love, a sign that true love in its deepest and richest form is being born in you, because you can't love people without suffering what they suffer. You can't love the world without suffering the crises that it suffers. You can't love animals without being heartbroken at what's happening to animals. What you need to be able to do is to create through sacred practice a container in which your suffering becomes a constant invitation to deeper and deeper compassion and more effective action, and doesn't paralyze you and doesn't overwhelm you. And that's what, through the grace of my teachers and through the grace of my own incurably joyful temperament, I've been able to do.
Deeply humbling. deeply
it
humbling.
It is, yes.
Embracing
the word. That's the word, isn't it? Because you can start with so many illusions about yourself, about your powers, about what you can do when you're young, and perhaps you need them to undergo the craziness that you have to undergo to start a real journey. But if you carry that kind of hubris into your 50s and 60s, you'll never become an elder, you'll never become a true spiritual leader, you'll never become an authentic teacher, and you'll never be able to help people in a crisis as overwhelming as the one we find ourselves in.
You mentioned the dark night of the soul, and I'm wondering, I'd love for you to share more about that, because there might be some folks listening that they've heard the term, they may not be sure what that is, but I think if you've been alive for any period of time, I think we've all faced a dark night of the soul. So I would love for you to just maybe explain what that is, and if there are any, I don't know, stages in the dark night, and how, for those that might be facing a dark night of the soul or about to face the dark night of the soul, how we can most gracefully surrender ourselves and go through the dark night in a way that is most transformative.
Well, the term the dark night of the soul is actually a classical mystical term and refers to a very specific stage in the mystical unfolding of the divinization process. It happens late, it happens after you've awoken to your divine consciousness, and it happens as a great mercy from the divine, because you cannot be transformed from an illumined human being into a divine human being without going through a carefully tailored death of the false self. Many people use a dark night of the soul to refer to trauma or great grief or a great disaster that happens to them, and that is actually an inaccurate use of the term, because the real dark night happens very rarely. It happens to advanced spiritual seekers. But what I would love to say to anybody who's suffering deeply out there is that two things. First, your suffering is not meaningless. It is profoundly part of your life's journey. It's a part of your karma. And the only way, secondly, to get through it with grace is to surrender to it and surrender to the divine that's allowing it, and to pray to be shown why it is happening and what its meaning is and what changes it's asking of you in your own deep temperament and in the way you live your life. If you can do that, if you can stay on your knees humbly, begging to be shown the meaning, you will be shown the meaning. And if you can surrender more and more deeply to what's happening to you without raging at it, without rebelling at it, you'll find that your understanding of God and your understanding of reality and your understanding of your own deepest strengths will immeasurably expand, because instead of being the victim of the suffering, you won't become the master exactly of the suffering, but you'll become the dance partner of the suffering, someone who can dance with its deep meanings and allow it to change you, to soften you, to humble you, to make you more aware of the suffering of others, and eventually, I hope, make you truly active in doing things with your resources to alleviate the suffering of others.
So you're saying surrender to the suffering. And I'm curious, though, because I think there might be a few folks listening that might go, well, you know, Andrew, I hear you. It sounds great, but, you know, I'm in a very abusive situation, and I'm suffering tremendously. How am I supposed to surrender to that, you know?
Oh, I wasn't thinking, I hear you, and in an abusive situation, you just get the hell out. And have the courage to choose your true self. I'm thinking of the great sufferings that come from the loss of a beloved, or the betrayal, or deep disasters that happen, or deep health challenges, or the kind of suffering that you'll inevitably feel when you wake up to the condition of the world. You have to, in those cases, accept that suffering and work with it and not try and deny it or drug it or escape it, because if you deny it and drug it and escape it, its deep, deep transformative richness will not be able to unfold in you. But of course, there are kinds of suffering that need to be addressed by legislative change. If you're a black American suffering racial abuse, to surrender to that suffering would be a nightmarish evasion of the real task, which is to change the whole attitude towards African Americans, the whole attitude towards racism.
Yes.
But in the deep personal trials that we all have through life's own unfolding, surrender to the divine is the way through. There's a wonderful poem by Rumi, which everybody going through a dark period should really get down. It's the greatest poem on suffering I've ever heard. It goes like this. It says, Rumi writes, "The grapes of my body can only become wine after the winemaker tramples me. I surrender my body like grapes to his trampling, so my inmost heart can blaze and dance with joy. And although the grapes go on sobbing blood and screaming, I cannot bear any more anguish. I cannot bear any more cruelty. The trampler stuffs cotton in his ears and says, 'It is I who am the master of this work. You can deny me if you want. You have every excuse. But when through my passion you reach perfection, you will never be done praising my name.'" Suffering is the tool with which the divine uses to sculpt our authentic self out of our inauthentic self. And when you come to great suffering, you come to a place where the divine is working directly on you through that suffering to sculpt your deep self. And if you evade the blows and don't surrender to the reality of what you're going through, the sculpture that's being prepared cannot be made. There's a marvelous story of Rumi when he says, look, there's a guy who goes to a tattoo parlor and he wants a lion on his back because he's got this vision of himself as a heroic lion. But as soon as the tattooist starts to do the tattooing, he starts screaming and he says, "Where are you? Where are you on the lion?" He says, "Oh, I'm at the tail." So he said, "Let's have a lion without a tail." And it goes on. A lion without a leg. You get the picture. So eventually the tattooist just flings all the tools on the ground. When you understand suffering in the deepest sense from that perspective, it becomes part of God's loving work on your nature. God doesn't just give us joy. God doesn't just give us ordinary forms of success. God gives us failure and ordeal, and they're both from the divine love, because the divine knows exactly what we need to be really transformed into the kind of loving agents of compassion that we are meant to be.
Yes, yes. So powerful, powerful. I hope you're all taking that in. The divine knows what we need. And I was just having a conversation, Andrew, with one of the other guests on the summit, talking about sometimes not getting what you want. You know, sometimes the suffering, sometimes not getting what you thought you wanted is actually the highest form of grace and blessing.
Oh, God, yes. This is one of the reasons why I loathe and abominate The Secret, because that defines success in getting exactly what you want and co-opting God to give you the Maserati or the Lamborghini or the Malibu mansion or the Cuban houseboy that you think you want.
Right.
Oscar Wilde said something fabulous. He said, look, if you want to punish somebody, give them exactly what they want. Because if you want from the ego, from the unhealed, aggressive, self-absorbed, narcissistic ego, then what you get from that desire will only ensnare you more in illusion, will only cut you off more from the true authentic sources of reality. So so many forms of what we call success are in fact disasters, and so much of one's true success comes from negotiating and suffering and surrendering to and learning from the deep failures that lie along anybody's real path. This is one of the great paradoxes of truth, isn't it?
Yeah. You're talking about surrender, and I'm right there with you. And I'm imagining maybe a few of the listeners going, okay, surrender. You know, we often, I want to surrender, but I'll surrender. Okay, I'll surrender, God, but not this and not that and not that.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
well, we all do that.
But that's not surrender. So, how to surrender, Andrew? Like, how?
Well, surrender really is one of the highest graces on the path, and you do need to earn surrender. And best way to learn how to surrender is, first of all, to learn how to love God, and how through loving God, through deep sacred practice, through adoration, to experience the burning, wild, holy love of God. Mm-hmm. When you have experienced enough of that love, when disaster comes to your life, you're so aware of the love of God that you can surrender to the laws of that love in your life. So surrender doesn't mean giving up or breaking down. It's not an act of weakness. It's an act of profound inner knowledge and an act of the greatest imaginable strength and an act of the greatest humility, because if you have done the work, if you've truly loved the divine, and if you truly experienced the divine as measureless, unconditional love, then when disaster and suffering and difficulty come, you will be strong enough to surrender, and you will be strong enough to take whatever is necessary for you to be transformed, and you'll be strong enough to trust, because your experience of the divine has already been so beautiful. So if you really want to learn surrender, learn how to love God, and learn how to experience God, so when you are tested, you won't go into denial or into rebellion. You will know that this too is a form of love, and you will surrender to the mystery of love and allow love to do the great work that love will do on you if you give yourself over to love in all of its forms with your whole being.
Powerful, powerful, surrendering to love. Wow. And why is it so, I guess, scary, you know, to surrender, and that fear? Because I think there's a deeper part of us that wants to, but it can be terrifying to surrender.
Yes.
Why is it so scary, and how do we deal with the fear that comes up? How do we work with the fear as it comes up of, okay, I'm going to really open bigger than myself. I'm going to surrender to my soul. I'm going to surrender to what's seeking to happen. How do we work with that fear?
I think there are really three ways. The first way is really to accept the fear and to truly understand it and to realize you are just another human being, and of course you are afraid of giving up your flimsy, vulnerable concepts of what life should be like and what you should be like and what God should be like. So often we feel ashamed of our fear, as if we're meant to be Superman or Superwoman, and that fear somehow humiliates us. Don't be humiliated by your fear. Accept it and let it make you truly, truly vulnerable and fragile and humble. Secondly, once that process is deepening in you, offer your fear to the Beloved. Say to God directly, I'm afraid. I'm afraid. I'm shaking. I feel absolutely at a loss. Don't hide your fear from the divine. Take that fear into a direct, naked, intimate relationship with the divine in whatever way you understand the divine, and open yourself up to the healing protection of the divine. And thirdly, you'll discover something that will very sober you up, really, which is that the fear will never go away. There won't come a time where you're so certain and so strong that you won't be afraid. But there will come a time when you can hold your fear in a much greater joy and much greater peace.
That's definitely sobering. Because I think that so often we're sold, you know, this idea of, if you do this thing, you do this process, you'll eliminate fear. You'll never have fear. You become fearless. And,
this is nonsense. This is absolute rubbish. Everybody who's ever given us any profound teachings on courage, from Socrates to the Dalai Lama to Gandhi, have said, look, true courage is not being not afraid. True courage is acknowledging your fear, but going ahead anyway, turning your whole destiny to the divine, so the divine can guide you and direct you, and having trust despite your fear in your mission and in the truth of what you stand for. That's courage. And you only have to look at the lives of the greatest men and women and read their diaries and read their autobiographies to know that even after the greatest possible mystical experiences, the greatest possible worldly success, when they come to the real threshold in their lives, they do shake, they do tremble, they are afraid, but they do not allow their shaking and their trembling and their fear to stop them going forward. And in fact, I think one of the things that people forget about fear is that there are ways in which fear is very important and very helpful. Sometimes one's not afraid enough. Sometimes you charge into a situation thinking, oh my God, here I am. I am the Errol Flynn of spirituality. I can transform this situation. And you meet all kinds of ambiguous and sometimes dark forces which hobble you and sabotage what you're doing. So fear can teach you humility. Fear can teach you discernment. Fear can warn you about people who give you wonderful impressions but are really very dark people. Fear can be a constant reminder of your limitations, which is sometimes a very good thing. So this contemporary dismissal of fear is really part of the catastrophic, idiotic pseudo-mysticism that's being sold in the bazaar. It has nothing to do with the reality of the path or the reality of human wisdom.
Beautiful. Again, humbling. You know, you mentioned, I have to go there, Andrew. I just something's nudging me because you said something, and I'm like, I've got to go there. So bear with me. You mentioned the secret, okay? You mentioned the secret, and I want to have a conversation. And I wasn't going to go there, but I'm like, screw it, let's go there. You mentioned the secret, and there's so much, you know, this idea of you manifest your life, you control your life, you're the one, you know, you're always in control. Just think a thought, and that's it. And I feel like it does create this sort of illusion for people.
It's a total illusion.
I see so many people like, oh, I didn't think of a positive thought, what's going to happen? And I think it creates an illusion that we are in control, and it so reinforces the illusion of the I and the ego and who we think we are. And I would love for you to talk about that. Like, are we in control? How much of our lives can we actually manifest? And, like, love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the secret is really, somebody once described to me in rather graphic terms, the whore of Babylon playing with herself in public. It's really a celebration of narcissism at a time when narcissism of every kind is devastating the planet. So I think it's an absolutely disgusting and blasphemous vision of both humanity and of humanity's relationship to God. We're not in relationship with the power that we can call upon to do what we want. Who the hell do we think we are? The divine is vastly powerful, vastly more powerful than anything that we can imagine. And much of our life is already written. Much of what we live is already ordained. And I discovered this once because I went to see some extraordinary astrologers in India called the Nadis, and they went and got a scroll and they read out my life, which was written on this scroll 3,000 years ago, all of the major incidents, the titles of my books, what was going to happen. I think if we really knew how much was already scripted, we would be very, very much humbler. So let's get absolutely real about who we really are. We are divine, but we're only divine when we die to the false illusions and the fantasies of human omnipotence, human agency, human power, and realize that if we are ever going to become who we truly can and must be, it'll only be when we truly understand that we are just a light drop of a great ocean of light, when we're truly humble, when we're truly open to grace and guided constantly by a power much greater than ourselves. Does that ring true for you?
Powerful. Yes. I mean, absolutely. I feel like, you know, there's this illusion we've been sold that we are in control and we are running.
Well, if we are in control, God help the world, because look at the world. Look at what our so-called fantasy of control has made of the planet. We believe we're in control of nature. Now we're destroying ourselves because we're destroying nature. We believe we are in control of our own evolutionary process, and that democracy and God knows what and capitalism are going to solve all the problems. They've created unbelievable problems. We're in a world that reveals to us how little control we truly have and how devastating the consequences of our hubris is.
What is then the the right relationship, because someone listening to this could go, maybe, okay, if I'm not in control, then, Andrew, why sacred activism? If I'm not in control, the universe is doing whatever it's doing, I'm not in control, it's being done, it's unfolding, you know, this sort of spiritual thing, it's just happening, then if I'm not in control, then I'm just going to just sit on the couch and do nothing and not meditate, not be a loving person, I'm not in control.
But there is one thing we are in control of, and this is very important. We are in control of our consciousness, of our attitude, of the way in which we react to how life unfolds. We are in control in the sense that through deep humility and through deep commitment to spiritual practice, through a passionate search for the divine, we can open up to much greater powers that can then flow through us. So once you analyze what you're not in control of and really accept it, you come across this tremendous gift that the divine has given us, the place where we are in control. And we're in control of every thought that we have. We're in control of every reaction potentially that we have. But in order to truly be in control of every thought and every reaction and every action, we need to surrender to the divine and be taught by the divine what the divine actually wants for us and for our world. And if you do that very difficult but very beautiful labor, what you will discover is that the divine is trying to birth a wholly new world right now from the darkness and the shattering and the dark night of our horrible world situation, that the true meaning of this world situation is that one whole set of human illusions is being incinerated so as to create a much humbler, much more cooperative, much more harmonious, much more balanced human race, and that what is needed is for people to really get into the truth of their one area of control and then follow the divine plan for a new world, and dedicate their love, their resources, their actions to being a humble midwife of the great birth through sacred activism. So you can't just get off the wheel by saying, oh, well, if it's all in the divine's control, I don't have to do anything. Yes, you do. You are a part of the divine. The divine is at work. You can, through grace, intuit something of what the divine is planning and what it wants. And your responsibility is to control your psyche, control your spirit, control your actions so that you can fulfill the deepest meaning of your incarnation and live out love in action.
Love it. Love in action. Not love in non-action, love in action. I want to, before I ask you the next question, you keep referencing the divine. And there might be a few folks going, what is the divine? What does Andrew mean? He keeps saying the divine. Like, when you say the divine, Andrew, what do you mean, the divine?
Well, I certainly don't mean an old man in the beard up in the sky. What I have experienced and what everybody can experience if they truly do the work is that there is an infinite light consciousness, a divine shattering white light. It's a diamond light. And that this light contains all knowledge, all joy, all being, all peace. And that I and that light and you and that light are not separate, because in the core of our being is a spark of that light, which once you experience directly that naked light that is God, that is called by many names, that is Allah, that is the Brahman, what you discover is that that light is permeating everything, has created everything, everything is a formation of that light, and that in your inmost consciousness, you are one with that light, and that light lives in you. That is the mystical journey, and that's how it's been described by all the mystics of all the traditions. So for me, God is that vast divine light consciousness, which I know myself at this stage to be in connection with whenever I quieten my soul and open to it in adoration and feel it pulsing through my body and burning in my heart and irradiating my mind. And I know that everybody has this light consciousness at the core of their being and can experience it, but to experience it, you do have to go on a serious, humble,
yes,
spiritual journey.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. I hope you're all listening in and really just digesting the wisdom of Andrew Harvey here. And,
well, it's not my wisdom. It's the unanimous testimony of the great mystics. What I've said you'll find in the Upanishads, what I've said you'll find in Rumi, what I've said you'll find in Jesus. It's always the same light that is seen at a certain stage in the path when your heart is clear enough to see it. And when you've done the work, you're given this overwhelming experience of the eternal light, and you're shown that the whole universe and all of the universes are created out of it, that all matter is condensed light energy. And at that moment, you know you are inseparable from the light in the intimate part of yourself. You're not the whole light. You are a drop of the great ocean of divine light, but connected through a mystery to all the other drops and fed by the power of the ocean. That's the astounding discovery.
Beautiful. What are some of the daily, are there any daily spiritual practices that you do, Andrew, that give
you? Oh, yes.
What would some of those be that you could share that perhaps the listeners could also practice that would help connect them more with that light?
Well, I would say to everybody out there, keep your practices simple. For one reason, the ego likes complicated practice because then it can feel proud of itself for doing spiritual practice. I am superior to everybody else because I do this immensely complicated practice in which I envisage God with 82 arms and 42 ornaments. For me, that is a complete distraction. I have boiled down my practices to three essential kinds of practice, and I use them at odd moments throughout the day. I begin my day with them, and then I end my day with them. The first practice is unconditional gratitude. It's the most powerful practice I know. I wake up and I thank God for being awake. I thank God for my cat sleeping next to me. I thank God that I've managed, despite everything, to have a small little place to live in. I thank God for my friends. I thank God for the beauty of the world. I thank God for the tasks that God has set me. So gratitude, and when I go to bed, I thank God for everything again. Cultivating gratitude as a fundamental attitude to life is a major way of coming to learn about the love that lies behind all things. The second practice that is extremely simple is the practice, what the Sufis call the practice of remembrance. And that is saying the name of the divine by whatever way or fashion or world you love the divine, by whatever tradition, saying the name of God, of the divine, in the core of your heart. If you are a Buddhist, say the name of the Buddha in the core of your heart. If you are a Hindu, say the name of Krishna or Vishnu in the heart. If you're a Christian, say the name of Jesus in the heart. Or if you don't want to belong to any of the religions, say beloved in the heart. It's an amazing practice. I often say beloved, 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 beloved. And then I begin to say beloved, 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 as if I'm also experiencing being the beloved of the beloved. So how I do it is to say it for 10 minutes in an act of adoration towards the universal beloved. And as I begin to feel that love that's streaming towards me from the eternal one, I start to dare to say beloved to my own mind, my own heart, my own body, because I'm registering or beginning to register just how infinitely loved I am as myself. That's an extremely powerful practice, and many of the great mystics of humanity have said that's the practice that everybody can do, that's the practice that can be done at all moments, that's the practice that will take you across all the rivers of illusion. And it's very much the center of mine. The third practice that I use a lot, especially in the world as it is now, is a practice that I learned from the Dalai Lama and wrote about in the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. It's a practice called Tonglen, and it's an immense, powerful practice. Fundamentally, Tonglen is about receiving suffering into your heart center and melting it away and sending to anybody who's suffering all your joy and all your peace and all your love. But there are three stages it's very important to do Tonglen in. The first stage is that you must do Tonglen in yourself. So what I do is to sit naked in front of a mirror, which at 63 is rather a challenging operation. And I just look at Andrew in the mirror, and I see Andrew's worry, anxiety, loneliness, suffering. But the person looking into the mirror is the enlightened part of myself, the Buddha part, the Christ part that is part of all of us. And I imagine all Andrew's pain coming out of his belly in the mirror, and I take it into my heart center, wide expanse of radiant sky, and I dissolve that smoke, and then I smile at Andrew, encouraging Andrew, saying, "You can do it, boy. You're not finished yet. You may have made all of these mistakes, but there's so much grace and there's so much help." And then you choose somebody who you love, who's going through great pain. Then you choose somebody you don't like and pray for their transformation. And then you choose a group of people or a situation that is really causing you real pain, and you absorb that pain and send back to that group of people or that situation the suffering that you have, the joy that you know is part of the enlightened nature. This is a hugely powerful practice, perhaps the most powerful mystical practice I think humanity has ever been given. And if anybody wants to know more about it, I've written this whole series out in my book, The Hope, because in that book I gave what I consider to be the really core practices for sacred activism, for becoming a lover, midwife, warrior of the new. And there's a long section there on Tonglen which will help you deeply, I hope.
Powerful. Powerful practices. Gratitude, the remembrance, saying the name of the divine in Tonglen. Amazing.
You can't go wrong with those three. If you only ever did those three, I've experimented in a lot of different systems, and it's important to choose what really moves you. You can, those three, you can hear those three and think, oh, they're gorgeous, I'll try. But if they don't really move you, don't do them. Go on looking until you find one that really shakes your whole being open with joy. That's the one that is destined for you. You have to be you have to experiment. But I think that all human beings can do the practice of gratitude. I think all human beings can do the name, and all human beings, if they truly know how desperate the situation is and how powerful on the inner levels unconditional love can do Tonglen. So that's why I chose to offer them at this moment.
Amazing. As you're listening in to this interview with Andrew Harvey, I invite each of you right now to practice at least one of those, and I think we can all definitely practice the gratitude. It's so simple, so often, because in its simplicity, overlooked, but if we really practice the unconditional, radical gratitude daily, I think it would be miraculous, truly miraculous. For sure, we would fall in love with ourselves in this moment in a very deep way. Now, Andrew, I'm curious, as you As you look in the world, it's kind of like two questions in one, but as you look at the world today and with everything you've experienced and seen, I'm wondering what you feel or what you see as the biggest problems humanity faces, and what we can do about it, what we can individually, because sometimes we look at life and go, you know, these problems are so huge, I'm just going to bury my head in the sand, forget about, do nothing, just live my life, because what difference can I make? So what are the biggest problems, and what we can all do individually to make a difference? And also, on the flip side, what most excites you about the world and humanity today?
Well, I think we're in a terrible, potentially terminal crisis. As anybody who really knows my work, I've been speaking up for 20 years about the enormous dangers that we face due to our total dissociation from nature, our separation from the divine within, and our massive hubris, our massive overconfidence in our own abilities. And when you join those three and mix them in a cocktail, you get a world crisis exploding everywhere on every level, which is the one that we are now seeing erupting in every realm. That's what's going on. But the truth is that if you've ever been through a dark night yourself, a real dark night in which you have lost everything and found something at the end of the night much greater than anything you ever knew, you understand that this crisis is a preparation for a birth. It's the birth canal through which humanity has to pass to be humbled and chastened and made supple and open to the sacred powers that can transform everything, even at 1 minute to midnight. And once you begin to intuit that, you realize that, yes, you can do a very great deal by becoming what I call a sacred activist, someone who fuses in the core of their being profound spiritual peace and passion and strength and awareness with a radical commitment to a real cause in the real burning world that really motivates you. Once you do that, and I know hundreds of people, thousands of people who are doing that right now, you discover that you will be filled with energy, you will be filled with meaning, you will be filled with purpose, you will be filled with joy, because you're really turning up humbly as an agent of the divine transformation, of the divine birth. And whether or not you succeed in your lifetime to realize your goal doesn't matter. What matters is that you turn up with your full being and do the work anyway out of a great love for humanity and a great love for God. And if you can do it in that spirit, giving up the fruits of action to the divine, you will live a divine life in whatever circumstances you find yourself in. And that's worth everything. That's what I know. I'm not talking about something I read about. I'm talking about something I live, and I know that it changes everything to live like this. I'm just thinking as I'm talking about this, about a woman I love. She is, I first met her when she was the head of a mining company. Very rich and very grand and very wild and very, very unhappy. And I said, why are you so unhappy? You've got all these millions. And she said, well, I don't know quite. And then I asked her, what do you really care about? What is really, really moving your heart? And she said, I'm desperate about what's happening to animals, so desperate that I can hardly bear think about it. And then I got very, very piercing with her. I said, you will never be happy until you face your heartbreak and until you give up this crazy life that is only damaging your soul and choose whatever it costs to really put your passion for animals into practice. And she screamed at me and she nearly threw me out of her house, but I'm a tough guy and we're great friends. Well, to cut a long story short, a year later, she'd given up her job, she had downsized, and she'd started a major wildlife foundation. And I saw her about 6 months ago. She's kicking ass all over the world. She's already got the Australian government to change its policies on the import and export of trophies. and she is radiant. She knows that all animals won't be saved by what she does. She knows the situation is very dire, but she's living her real sacred purpose, and that always gives you joy. That's success. Success is living your real sacred purpose and doing it all anyway, whatever happens, whether you're successful in the world sense or defeated, doesn't matter as much as whether you're turning up with grace and joy and purpose and passion and risking it all just for the sheer love of humanity and God.
And right there, success is living your real sacred purpose, regardless of what happens, and risking it all.
Yeah.
Well, beautiful, beautiful. I have two final questions for you, Andrew. It's been a really enlightening conversation, inspiring conversation for sure for me.
I hope
and,
so. I hope people can hear that this is really, we talked about suffering, we talked about the horror of the world, but my deep discovery, especially in the last years, has been that there is living in all of us, every single one of us, a whole wild fountain of bliss and passion and joy and peace that is the divine within us. And you can all live irrigated by this on one condition, that you truly give your life up to service, to real service of real people or animals in the real world. Service is the door to true transcendent success.
Powerful, powerful. Service is the door to real transcendent success. Amazing, amazing. So I just invite you all, as you're listening to this interview, as I ask Andrew two more questions, feel into as you explore success, moving beyond just what can I get, but you know, who am I really deeply as you evolve.
And what have I been sent here to give? It's not about what you can get. The truth is that if you abandon yourself to your sacred purpose, you will meet amazing people. You will be helped by the powers that create the universe. Your life will not be easy, but it will be beautiful, and it will be holy, and it will be glorious. And when you die, even if all the passions that you have spent your life living for have not been realized, you will know that you turned up and you gave everything, and that will bring you peace. What else is worth anything?
What else is there to do? Right
now.
What else is there to do? Hopefully, well, I'm inspired. I'm inspired. So two final questions, Andrew. If there were, you said a lot, and a lot of amazing souls are stirring, I can feel, listening to this conversation. If there were three key life lessons, I would say the most important life lessons, and you've shared a lot already, but if there were three of the most important life lessons that you've learned, that if you could only pass on these three keys to the next generation that you feel would, let's say, evolve the next generation of consciousness the most, what would these three keys be that you would pass on to the next generation?
The first thing I would say is, please understand that the core of your purpose is to realize your divine identity, to know it. So make the center of your life a rigorous, humble, unfolding spiritual path. Nothing else is important, finally, but that. Secondly, love animals wildly. Because if you truly, truly open to animals with adoration, you will be rewarded not only by their incredible capacity for unconditional love, you'll be initiated into the glory of the creation, into the amazing beauty of what it is to be one member amongst others in this vast, pulsing, radiant web of life. Thirdly, cultivate sacred friendship as the highest form of love. Realize that love isn't just an erotic experience. Love is the meeting of two souls in a shared divine purpose. And there is no greater love than that. And if you're lucky enough to really cultivate that, you will experience it. And you'll experience the support, the encouragement, the wisdom of others that will give you enormous strength in very difficult circumstances. the great work that we are called to do now on the planet cannot be done by anyone alone. We do have the responsibility for our own psyches and spiritual practice, but we have a greater responsibility, which is to join with like-minded hearts and souls and cultivate sacred friendships so that we can together, humbly, working, loving, supporting, encouraging each other, go forward and change our world to a world in which the sacred is respected on every level and human beings and animals live in harmony and the creation again has its primal place at the center of all of our hearts.
Three powerful, powerful keys. I trust you're digesting those keys. Powerful keys. You know, Angie, one of the things I really envision for this summit is that people don't just listen. You talk about sacred activism, which I love, embodying the divine, embodying love in action. So one of the things I really want is that we digest the message, we listen to the principles, the ideas, the sharing, the transmission, but also act. So I would love for you to assign a soul homework, a homework assignment for each person listening so that it's something simple that they can actually go and do, put the love in
God,
action
I'd
right
love
now.
To.
Right now, before they even go back into their lives, what's something that they can actually do right now?
Absolutely. Well, the most important thing that you could do, my friends out there, is to ask the divine truly and sincerely to uncover for you the purpose that you're placed on the earth for. What cause are you really, in the depths of yourself, called to honor and work for now? So I'm inviting you to get up tomorrow night or night quite soon at about 4 o'clock in the morning when the world is completely quiet. And I'm inviting you to surround yourself by the grace and the peace of the divine in whatever way is natural to you. And then I'm inviting you to ask yourself one question, one very intense question, and to really ask it until you get an answer. And the question is, what of all the causes in the world, in this burning world, really breaks my heart the most? What really affects my heart the most? If you're like me, you probably feel a very great deal of suffering about so many things, women, treatment, homosexuals, the environment, animals. But when I ask myself that question, I discovered that what really tortures my deepest heart is the way in which we treat animals, because I've been privileged to have amazing revelatory relationship with animals, and my love for them is the burning center of my life. So when I ask myself that question, I realize that I'd been called not just to write the map, I hope, of sacred activism in my book, The Hope, and to in my institute, but to be an advocate for animals, just to stand up there and howl and cry and beg on their behalf that we awaken to the horror of the worldwide Auschwitz that we've created, restore our relationships with them in humility so they can teach us what they're longing to teach us, how to live in harmony in this great unified field. But what is your heartbreak? If you find your heartbreak, then you can create what I've described of in my book, and I do. If I've inspired you, please read The Hope, because there's a whole map of how to do this transformation there. If I've inspired you, then what I say in The Hope is that once you've discovered your heartbreak, find others who share that heartbreak and create a network of grace in your own community and come together and love each other and encourage each other and pray together and meditate, and then set about really doing something about that heartbreak in your local community. Every community now has got a whole slew of problems, and your heartbreak will be connected to one of them. Do something real about that with a group of people that you love and are supported by, and you'll discover your life's purpose, you'll discover sacred community, and you'll discover that when you truly act on behalf of what breaks your heart the most, you'll uncover inside yourself a deathless passion that will feed you energy whatever happens. And that's the great discovery of life, and it's an amazing one. And it will give you joy, the greatest joy, the highest joy.
Beautiful. You heard it, everyone. Your homework has been assigned by Andrew Harvey. It's soul work. You know, it's life work. Feel into what is your greatest heartbreak. the cause that burns in your heart the most, and create a network, a community, and do something about it. So many times we feel the call and we feel the sense, but we don't do anything about it. It's time to put love in action, for sure. Thank you so much, Andrew. This has been an amazing, amazing conversation. I'm sure each listener is grateful for this moment to be with you. I would love for you, Andrew, just to share with everyone listening, what's the best way people can find out about your amazing work, your books,
well,
and
thank you
the best
so
website
much.
to connect with you?
Well, first of all, thank you for your beautiful heart. And thank you for your enthusiasm, and thank you for the depth of your questions. I initially, when I was shown a success summit, rolled my eyes and thought, oh my God, the last thing I want to do is to join some new age celebration of me, me, me. I hate all of that stuff. To me, that's disgusting rubbish in the face of what we're actually facing. So when I really got the questions, I was absolutely thrilled. And now, of course, I remember you from the past. So thank you for this work, because you're redefining success in the only way that makes any sense in our situation.
Yes.
If anybody truly wants to get in touch with me, I can be found on the web at andrewharvey.net. There is a YouTube channel. There are many videos for free on my website. But the way in which you'd connect with my heart the most is through the book that launched this global movement of sacred activism, The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism. Everything that I've tried to convey to you in this talk is in that book. It took me 10 years, very difficult years, to write, and it has started a global movement, and I'm begging you to be part of it in your own unique, wonderful way. The time has come for millions of us to rise in the golden yeast of divine love consciousness and to put our deepest love into action together, because that's the only force that can change this terrible situation. The meaning of this terrible situation is to activate that force, become one of those who burn with love for the world and burn with the passion to do something about it, join with others, discover sacred fellowship, and live in joy, whatever the hell or heaven happens.
Amazing, amazing. Andrew Harvey, thank you so much, Andrew. You've been a real inspiration and a blessing in my life, and I know for everyone listening in today. And everyone, I just want you just to send love to Andrew right now, wherever he is, and bless his heart, bless his soul, bless his spirit, and bless your work, Andrew. May you continue to go out and just be used by the divine in the highest way. So I hope you've all been taking lots of notes, and we're going to post Andrew Harvey's links along with this interview. I invite you to check out his website and go out and get the book, The Hope, and check out all of his books, but The Hope, get The Hope, and practice it in your life. Amazing, amazing. I told you this was going to be a truly inspiring moment, an inspiring interview with Andrew Harvey. And, you know, if you're listening to the Success Summit, if you're listening to especially this interview, your soul is ready. Your soul is truly ready, that something more than before is seeking to happen through you. And, you know, just remember, we are redefining success, and it's not just what you attain in this life. Nothing in this life is permanent. It's all impermanent and transitory. And at the end of one's life, you take nothing with you but the evolution of your soul. So as you move on from this interview, practice, go inside, live your love, and just sending you lots of love, everyone. It's been amazing. I'm kind of speechless in this moment and deeply inspired myself, as I hope you are. We'll be bringing the summit back in our next session and continuing to dive deep together. Let's keep diving deep. Love now. Blessings, everyone.
The moderator has left the conference.